twins placed in the firmament, as well as in the earthly order of things, had been secured for them even before they were born. She knew that nothing, not even the familiar scent of eucalyptus, or the sight of its leaves thrust into her nostril, or the drum roll of rain on corrugated tin roof, or the visceral odor of a freshly opened abdomen, could ever be the same again. Chapter 9. Where Duty Lies. Hema wielded her scalpel like a woman on fire. No time to tie off bleeders, and, in any case, very little bleeding along the way, not a good sign. She opened the glistening peritoneum and quickly positioned retractors to hold the wound edges back. The uterus bulged out of the wound. Then, before her eyes, it seemed to swell and turn luminous. She stood frozen until she realized it was because the sun had suddenly struck the frosted window and lit up the table. In all her years operating at missing, she couldn't remember that happening before. Just as Hema feared, there was a lateral tear in the uterus. Blood had filled the broad ligament on one side. That meant that once she got the babies out, she'd have to do an emergency hysterectomy, no easy task in pregnancy, what with the uterine arteries being tortuous, thickened, and carrying half a liter of blood a minute. Not to mention the massive blood clot shimmering in the light, growing before her eyes and gloating at her like a smiling Buddha, as if to say, "Hema, I have completely distorted the anatomy. Dissection is going to be bloody difficult, and your landmarks will all be gone, but come on in anyway, why don't you?" Hema believed in numerology. Next to one's name, nothing was as important as numbers. "What is it about this day?" she asked herself. "It's the 20th day of the 9th month. No 4s or 7s in there. Airplane almost crashes, a child breaks his leg. I crack a Frenchman's nuts. What more, I say, what more?" She rapped Stone's knuckles with her scissors. "Stop!" He was fumbling with an oozing vessel when she needed him to retract. She incised the uterus and tried to deliver the twin who sat higher in the uterus, but was nevertheless head down, upside down. This twin would have been the second to come out had delivery proceeded through the birth canal, but now it would be the firstborn. But strangely, this twin, hand jammed against its cheek, wouldn't budge. She extended the uterine wound. She suctioned the infant's mouth. She drew a sharp breath that inverted her mask against her lips because she could see the problem. The babies were joined at the head. A short, fleshy tube passed from the crown of one to the other, a tube that was narrower and of a darker hue than the umbilical cords. They were tethered together, but there was a fatal tear in this stalk, a jagged opening caused no doubt by Stone's fishing with his Basio tribe. And from this rent, what little blood the two infants possessed was pumping out. "Please, God," she thought, "let this be only a blood vessel, and a minor one at that. Let there be no brain, or meninges, or ventricle, or cerebral artery, or cerebrospinal fluid, or whatnot in it." She spoke aloud to Stone now, to the room, to God, and to the twins whose lives, if they survived, might be irrevocably affected by this decision.
"They could have seizures the minute I cut this. One twin could bleed out and the other overfill with blood. They could get meningitis."
This was a technique surgeons used when difficult decisions had to be made. Think aloud for your assistant, because it might help clarify the issues for yourself. And theoretically, it gave the assistant time to point out her faulty reasoning, though she wasn't about to take an opinion from the man responsible for this blunder. A careful decision was needed so as not to blunder again. It was often the second mistake that came in the haste to correct the first mistake that did the patient in.
"No choice," she said. "I have to cut."
She put clamps across the stalk where it emerged from each infant's scalp. She invoked Lord Shiva's name, held her breath, and cut above each clamp, bracing herself for something terrible. Nothing happened. She tied off the stumps. She cut the umbilical cord and easily pulled out the first infant, a male. She handed it to the gowned and gloved probationer who stood nearby. This baby had been spared his father's probings. Then she pulled out the other infant, Again a boy, an identical twin, whose scalp was bloodied from Stone's knife and whose skull would have been crushed had she not arrived. Both infants were tiny, 3 pounds at best, clearly less than full term, a month premature, perhaps more. Neither infant cried. Distracted now by heavy oozing from Sister Mary Joseph Braze's soggy, friable uterus, Hema turned back from infants to the mother.
"What is a BP?"
Hema asked, peering over the drapes, first at Nurse Asqual and then at Sister Mary Joseph Braze's face. The anesthetist, the whites of her eye showing like saucers, shook her head. Beautiful Sister Mary Joseph Braze's face now looked bloated and lifeless.
"More blood! For God's sake, pour it in!"
Hema shouted. As she toiled in the now deflated cavity of the belly, Hemalatha remembered that when she'd handed over the second baby to the probationer, she had been surprised to find the probationer still standing there, holding the first, a blank look on her face. But Hema had no time to worry about that. Once the babies were out, her duty as an obstetrician was to turn completely to Sister Mary Joseph Braze. Her duty was to the mother. Chapter 10 Dance of Shiva. We two unnamed babies, newly arrived, were without breath. If most newborns meet life outside the womb with a shrill, piercing wail, ours was the saddest of all songs, the stillborn song of silence. Our arms weren't clamped to our breasts, our hands did not make fists. Instead, we were limp and floppy, like two wounded flounders. The legend of our birth is this. Identical twins, born of a nun who died in childbirth, father unknown, possibly, yet inconceivably, Thomas Stone. The legend grew, ripened with age, and, in the retelling, new details came to light. But looking back after 50 years, I see that there are still particulars missing. After labor stalled, I dragged my brother back into the womb and out of harm's way as lances and spears came at him through our only natural exit. The attack ceased. Then I remember, and I believe I do, the muffled voices, the tugging and sawing outside. As the rescuers neared us, I recall the blinding glare and the strong fingers pulling at me. The shattering of the darkness and the silence, the deafening racket outside was so great that I almost missed the moment when we were physically separated, when the cord connecting my head to Shiva's fell away. The shock of that parting lingers. Even now, what I think about most isn't that I lay there without breathing, immobile in the copper basin, born to the world yet not alive. Instead, I recall only the parting from Shiva. But to return to the legend, the probationer unloaded the two still bones into a copper basin used to hold placentas. She carried the basin to the window. She made a notation in the delivery chart, Japanese twins connected by the head but now disconnected. In her eagerness to be useful, she completely forgot her ABCs, airway, breathing, and circulation. Instead, she thought of what she had read the previous night about jaundice of the newborn and the helpful role of sunlight. She'd memorized that passage. She wished she had read about Japanese twins, the word Siamese eluded her, or asphyxiated babies. But the fact was she hadn't. She'd read about jaundice. But then, as she set the basin down, she realized that for sunlight to work, the babies had to be alive, which these weren't. Her sorrow and shame made her confusion worse. She turned away. The twins lay face to face, feeling the basin's galvanic touch against their skin. In the chart, the probationer used the words white asphyxia to describe their deathly pallor. The sun, which had stage-lit the room moments before, now honed in on the basin. The copper glowed orange. Its molecules became agitated. Its prana rose into the infant's translucent skin and passed into their doughy flesh. Hemalatha dissected the broad ligaments, then clamped the uterine arteries, praying that she wouldn't accidentally clamp the ureters and shut down the kidneys in that bloody mess.
"Quick, quick, quick!"
She was tempted to smack Stone on the forehead instead of on the knuckles.
Retract properly, man!
She followed his gaze to Sister Mary Joseph Braze's head, which bobbed like a rag doll's as the anesthetist tugged at her arm to find another vein. Matron, teary and lost in her grief, stroked Sister Mary Joseph Braze's other hand. When Hema finally delivered the uterus, clamps and all, into a basin, she saw no pulsations in the abdominal aorta. Her hands, steady till now, shook as she loaded a syringe with adrenaline and attached a 3.5-inch needle to it. She lifted Sister Mary Joseph Braze's left breast, hesitated for a moment, invoked God's name again, then plunged the needle between the ribs and into the heart. She pulled the plunger back, and a mushroom of heart blood appeared in the syringe. Whenever I've had to resort to adrenaline to the heart, it has never worked, Hema said to herself. Not once. Maybe I do it as a way to signal to myself that the patient is dead. But surely it must have worked somewhere with someone. Why else was it taught to us? Hemalatha prided herself on being methodical in an emergency, keeping her cool. But she stifled a sob now as she waited, her right hand buried in Sister Mary Joseph Braze's abdomen, palm down, just over the spine, waiting for a throb in the aorta, a slap to register in her fingers. She couldn't forget that this was dear sister's heart she was trying to jumpstart, and whose life was slipping away. They'd shared the bond of two Indian women in a foreign land. The bond extended back to the Government General Hospital in Madras, India, even though they hadn't known each other there. To share a geography and a landscape of memory made them sisters, a family. And Hema could see her sister's hands turning blue, the nail beds dusky, and the skin turning dull. It was the hand of a corpse, and holding it was Matron, her head bowed as if she were asleep. Hema waited longer than she might have under normal circumstances. It was some time before she could bring herself to say, her voice breaking,
"No more. We have lost her."
It was during this hiatus of activity in the room that the firstborn, the one who'd been spared a skull puncture, signaled its presence. It wrapped its hands on the copper basin. It brought its left heel down to produce a muffled gong. Now that it had come wholly forth from a dying womb, it reached both arms skyward and then to its right, to its brother. "Here I be," it announced. "Forget the shoulds and coulds and might-haves and hows and whys. I am sympathetic to the situation, the circumstance, and in due course we can explore the details and, in any case, birth and copulation and death. That's all the facts when you come down to brass tacks. I've been born, and once is enough. Help my brother. Look, here, come at once, help him." Hemalatha ran over at this summons, saying, "Shiva, Shiva," invoking the name of her personal deity, the god whom others thought of as the destroyer, but who she believed was also the transformer, the one who could make something good come out of something terrible. Later she would say that she'd assumed the worst about the twins. One of them had his head bloodied, and then there was the matter of her dividing the fleshy tube that connected them, and God knows how much distress they'd been in before she cut them free of the womb. But she'd also assumed that Matron or the probationer or both would be reviving the infants while she worked on the mother, though she recalled seeing Matron seated and immobile. The probationer was mortified at the sound of a baby that had come alive right behind her back, confounding her most basic clinical assumptions. The child was no longer white, but pink, and not jaundiced. The other infant was a robin's egg blue, and it was still and unmoving, as if it were the discarded chrysalis from which the crying baby had emerged. Matron, hearing that newborn cry, jumped off her stool. Her glance let the probationer know she was a hopeless case. Hemalatha went to work on the twin that was unmoving, while Matron hastened to clean up the living one. The breathing twin gazed out from the copper vessel. Its puffy, newborn eyes surveyed the room, trying to make sense of its surroundings. There stood the man everyone took to be the father, a tall, sinewy white man, looking lost in his own theater. The father's hands were preternaturally pale from the talc that lingered on them after he'd stripped off his gloves. His fingers were clasped together in a posture shared by surgeons, priests, and penitents. His blue eyes were set deep in the orbits under a ledge of a brow which could make him look intense, but on this day made him look dull. From the shadows sprung the great axe blade of a nose that was sharp, in keeping with his profession. His lips were thin and straight, as if drawn with a ruler. Indeed, the face was all straight lines and sharp angles, coming to a point in a lancet-shaped chin, as if it had all been carved out of a single square of granite. His hair was parted on the right, a furrow that originated in boyhood, with every follicle tamed by the comb to know exactly which direction it was to tilt. The top was cut unevenly, as if after saying, "A short back and sides!" He'd risen from the chair when that was accomplished, despite the barber's protests. It was the kind of obstinate, determined face that, with a spyglass held to the eye and a ponytail, wouldn't have been out of place on the deck of an English man-of-war. Except, of course, for the tears rolling freely down the cheeks. And from that tear-stained face, a voice emerged.
"What about Mary?"
Startling everyone, because it had been silent for so long. The measured syllables had the quality of a slow fuse.
"I'm sorry, Thomas. It is too late,"
said Hemalatha, as she suctioned the infant's pharynx, then pushed air into the baby's lungs, her movements speedy and almost frantic. The irritation with Stone was gone from her voice, and pity had taken its place. She stole a glance at him over her shoulder. A wrenching noise emerged from Stone's mouth, the cry of an unsound mind. He'd been a passive observer and a worthless assistant ever since Hamer's arrival. Now he leaped forward and grabbed a scalpel from the tray. He placed a hand on Sister Mary Joseph Brace's chest. Hemalatha thought of restraining him and then decided it wasn't prudent to approach a man wielding a knife. Stone lifted Sister Mary Joseph Brace's breast. The motto of those pioneers of resuscitation, the Royal Humane Society, resounded in his ears. "Latiat scintillula forsan. A small spark may perhaps be hidden." He pushed the breast up and out of the way, and under his knife a red gash appeared between the fourth and fifth ribs. He drew the knife over the wound again, and yet again, till he was through muscle. If he was clumsy earlier, his movements now were those of a man incapable of tentative strokes. He cut the cartilages that connected the two ribs to the breastbone. He spread the ribs and watched in disbelief as his ungloved hand slid out of sight and into the still warm cavity of her chest. The spongy lung he pushed away. And there, under his fingers like a dead fish in a wicker basket, was Sister Mary Joseph Brace's heart. He squeezed, surprised at its size, barely able to encircle it. Meanwhile, he exhorted the nurse anesthetist to keep pushing air into her lungs, not to stop. His right hand was buried within her thorax, but his eyes were on Sister Mary's engorged left breast, which he held out of the way with his left hand. The breast felt firm, unlike the slippery, soft heart. He saw blotchy blue shadows creep into her face, a hue that her brown skin shouldn't have been capable of. Her abdomen had collapsed, its surface crinkled like an airless balloon, its two halves splayed open like a book whose spine had given way.
"God! God! God!"
Stone cried with every squeeze, calling on a God he had renounced once and didn't believe in. But Sister Mary believed, rising before dawn to pray and lingering in prayer at night before she slept. Every beat of her life and each day of her calendar had been filled with God events, and no morsel of food entered her mouth without God's blessing. "Make your life something beautiful for God." If Thomas Stone never understood it, he respected it, because it was the same quality she brought to the operating theater and to the textbook she'd helped him with. That was why he called out God's name now. Because if there was a God, God bloody well owed his devoted servant, Sister Mary Joseph Braise, a miracle. Otherwise, God was the shameless fraud Stone had always found him to be. If you want me to believe, God, I'll give you another chance. The theater door swung open. All eyes turned to the figure that entered. But it was only wide-eyed Gebru, priest, servant of God, and watchman. The covered bowl he carried held the injera and wort, and their scent was added to that of the placenta, blood, amniotic fluid, and meconium. Gebru had hesitated to come into this sanctum sanctorum. He held the food container in front of him, unsure if it were the ingredient that might save the day. His eyes almost popped out of their sockets when he saw, on the altar of this hallowed place, Sister Mary Joseph Braise open like a sacrificial lamb, with Stone's hand in her chest. He started to shake. He put the food on the floor, squatted down against a wall, pulled out his beads, and swayed in prayer. Stone redoubled his efforts. "I demand a miracle, and I want it right now," he said, his body rocking back and forth. He kept it up, even when the heart had turned mushy in his hands, and he was shouting now. "The bloody loaves and fishes, Lazarus, the lepers, Moses and the Red Sea!" Gebru's chanting in ancient gears matched Stone, call and response, as if Gebru were translating because in this hemisphere, God didn't know English. Stone looked up to the ceiling, prepared for the tiles to part and for an angel to intercede where surgeons and priests had failed. All he saw was a black spider hanging down from its web, with its compound eyes taking in the scene of human misery below. Stone's shoulders slumped, and though his hand was still in Sister Mary's thorax, he was now merely caressing her heart, no longer squeezing. His chest heaved, tears falling onto the body of Sister Mary Joseph Braise. His head fell forward so it rested on his arms, which rested on Sister's chest. No one dared approach. They were transfixed by the sight of their surgeon so defeated, so destroyed. At long last he looked up, seeing as if for the first time the green tile going halfway up the wall, the swinging green door to the autoclave room, the glass instrument case, the bloody uterus with its necklace of hemostats lying in the green towel, the blue-black placenta right next to it on the specimen table, and the jade-colored ground-glass windows through which sunlight filtered. How did these things dare to exist if Mary did not? That was when his eyes fell on the twins, no longer in their copper throne. That was when he saw the orange halo of light that surrounded the two boys. Somehow both children were alive, bright-eyed, one of them seeming to study him, the second one now as pink as the first. "Oh, no, no, no," he said in a pitiful voice. "No, that was not the miracle I asked for." When he withdrew his hand from Mary's body, it made a gurgling sound. He left the theater. He came back with a long broom. He brushed the spider off the ceiling, and then, with his heel, he ground it into the tile. Matron understood he was intent on blasphemy. In case the arachnid was God, he was killing God.
"Thomas," Hemulata said, using his first name, which sounded strange on her tongue in Operating Theatre 3, because they were always formal here.
By this time, both babies were in Hema's arms, wiped off and suctioned and swaddled in receiving blankets. The one in whose skull Stone had tried to drill a hole had aspirated some amniotic fluid, but now seemed recovered. There was a big pressure dressing in place over the head wound. The other child showed only the stump of the flesh bridge that had connected him to his brother, a stump now tied off with umbilical cord suture. Hemulata had established that the boys could move their limbs, neither of them was cockeyed, and they seemed to hear and to see.
"Thomas,"
she said, approaching, but he cringed. He turned away. He would not look. This man she thought she knew well, 7 years a colleague, now stood bent as if he'd been gutted. That, she said to herself, is visceral pain. As angry as she'd been with him, the depth of his grief and his shame moved her. All these years, she thought, it should have been clear to us that he and sister were a perfect match. Maybe if we'd encouraged them, it could have been something more. How often did I see sister assisting him in surgery, working on his manuscripts, taking notes for him in the outpatient department? Why did I assume that was all there was to it? I should have reached over and smacked him at my dinner table. I should have shouted at him, "Don't be blind. See what you have in this woman. See how she loves you. Propose to her, marry her. Get her to discard her habit, renege on her vows. It's clear her first vow is to you." But no, Thomas, I didn't do it because we all assumed that you were incapable of anything more. Who knew that this much feeling was hidden in your heart? I see it now. Yes, now we have these two as proof of what was in your hearts. The two bundles in her arms propelled her forward, because they were, after all, his, and even as she thought that, she was still fighting her own disbelief. Surely he wouldn't try to deny that fact. She couldn't back away from this moment. She had to force the issue. Who else could speak for these children? Stone was a fool who lost the one woman in the world fated for him. But now he had gained two sons, and Missing would rally round these infants. He'd have lots of help. She moved closer. "What shall we name these babies?" She could sense the uncertainty in her voice. He appeared not to hear. After a pause, she repeated the question. Stone thrust his chin at her, as if to say she could name them whatever she wanted. "Please get them out of my sight," he said very softly. He kept his back turned on the infants to gaze once more at Sister Mary Joseph Braise, which is why he missed the way his words fell on Hema like hot oil. He didn't see the flames of anger shooting out of her eyes. Hema would misread his intentions, and he hers. Stone wanted to run away, but not from the children or from responsibility. It was the mystery, the impossibility of their existence that made him turn his back on the infants. He could only think of Sister Mary Joseph Braise. He could only think of how she'd concealed this pregnancy, waiting who knows for what. In response to Hamer's question, it would have been a simple thing for Stone to say, "Why ask me? I know no more than you do about this." Except for the certainty that sat like a spike in his gut that it was somehow his doing, even though he had no recollection how or where or when. Sister Mary Joseph Braise lay lifeless and unburdened of the two lives she had carried, as if that had been her sole earthly purpose. Matron had pulled down Sister Mary Joseph Braise's eyelids, but they would not stay closed. The half-mast eyelids, the unseeing gaze, hammered in the reality of her death. Stone took one last look. He wanted to remember her not as sister, not as his assistant, but as the woman he should have declared his love for, the woman he should have cared for, the woman he should have wed. He wanted the ghoulish image of her corpse burned into his brain. He had negotiated his way through life by work, and work, and more work. It was the only arena in which he felt complete, and the only thing he had to give Sister Mary Joseph Braise. But at this moment, work had failed him. The sight of her wounds shamed him. There'd be no healing. No scars to form, harden, and fade on her body. He would bear the scar. He would carry it from the room. He'd known only one way of being, and it cost him. But he would have been willing to change for her had she only asked. He would have. If only she could have known, What did it matter now? He turned to leave again, glancing around as if to seal in his memory this place in which he'd polished and elevated his art, this place that he'd furnished to suit his needs and that he thought was his real home. He took it all in because he knew he'd never, ever return. He was surprised to find Hema still standing behind him, and again the sight of the bundle she carried made him recoil.
"Stone, think about this," Hema said. "Turn your back on me if you want, because I'll have no use for you, but don't turn your back on these children. I won't ask you again."
Hema held her living burden and waited on Stone. He was on the verge of speaking to her honestly, of telling her all. In his eyes, she saw pain and puzzlement. What she didn't see was any recognition of the infants as being connected to him. He spoke like a man who'd just been hit on the head.
"Hema, I don't understand who... why they are here. Why Mary is dead."
She waited. He was circling around a truth that might emerge if she waited. She wanted to grab his ears and shake it out of him. At last, he met her gaze, refusing to look down at the infants, and what he said wasn't what she'd wanted to hear.
"Hema, I don't want to set eyes on them. Ever."
The last of Hema's restraint fell away. She was livid for the children, furious that he seemed to think this was just his loss.
"What did you say, Thomas?"
He must have known a battle line had just been drawn.
"They killed her," he said. "I don't want to set eyes on them."
So this is how it will be, Hema thought. This is how we shall pass from each other's lives. The twins mewled in her arms.
"Whose are they, then? Aren't they yours? So didn't you kill her, too?"
His mouth opened in pain. He had no answer, so he turned to leave.
"You heard me, Stone. You killed her,"
Hema said, raising her voice so that she drowned out every other sound. He flinched as the words lashed into him. It pleased her. She felt no pity. Not for a man who wouldn't claim his children. He pushed the swinging door so hard it shrieked in protest.
"Stone, you killed her!" she shouted after him. "These are your children!"
The probationer broke the ensuing silence. She was trying to anticipate, so she opened a circumcision tray and pulled on gloves. The one thing Matron allowed her to do without supervision was to use the foreskin guillotine. But instead of praising her, Hema pounced on her.
"My goodness, girl, don't you think these children have had quite enough? They are preemies. They are not out of danger. Want them to be chipcock Charlies on top of all this? And you, what have you been doing all this time, eh? You should have been worrying about their swallowing ends, not their watering cans."
Hema rocked the twins, thrilled by their breathing selves, by their peaceful smiles, the opposite of the usual anxious, panicked face of a newborn. Their mother lay dead in the same room. Their father had run, but they knew nothing of that. Matron, Gebru, the nurse anesthetist, and others who had gathered were weeping around sister's body. Word had spread to the maids and housekeepers. Now a funeral wail, a piercing lululululu, ripped through the heart of missing. The ululations would continue for the next few hours. Even the probationer began to show her first inkling of sound nursing sense. Instead of struggling to appear to be something she was not, she wept for sister, who was the only nurse who really understood her. For the first time, the probationer saw the children not as fetuses or neonates, but instead as motherless children, like herself, children to be pitied. Her tears poured out. Her body slumped as if the starch had vanished not just from her clothes, but from her bones. To her amazement, Matron came and put an arm around her. She saw not just sadness, but fear in Matron's face. How could Missing go on without Sister? Or without Stone? For surely he was never coming back, that she could see. Hemalatha shut out the sobbing around her as she rocked the babies. And then she began to croon, her anklets jingling faintly like castanets as she shifted weight from one foot to the other. She felt the loss of Sister Mary Joseph Brays as acutely as anyone. And yet she felt guided, perhaps this was Sister's doing, to give her all at this moment to the two infants. The twins were breathing quietly, their fingers fanned over their cheeks. They belonged in her arms. How beautiful and horrible life is, Hema thought. Too horrible to simply call tragic. Life is worse than tragic. Sister Mary, Bride of Christ, now gone from the world into which she just brought two children. Hema thought of Shiva, her personal deity, and how the only sensible response to the madness of life in this, her 30th year, was to cultivate a kind of madness within, to perform the mad dance of Shiva, to mimic the rigid masking smile of Shiva, to rock and sway and flap six arms and six legs to an inner tune, a tabla beat. Tim taga taga tim taga tim tim taga. Hema moved gently, knees flexing, tapping her heels, then her forefoot in time to the music in her head. The bit players in Theatre 3 regarded her as if she were mad, but she danced on even as they tidied the corpse. She danced as if her minimalist gestures were shorthand for a much larger, fuller, reckless dance, one that held the whole world together, kept it from extinction. Ridiculous, the thoughts that came to her as she danced. Her new Grundig, Adid's lips and his long fingers, the thump of Matron falling over, the revolting feel of the Frenchman's balls, but the satisfaction in seeing the color flee his face. Gibru with chicken feathers stuck to him. What a journey. What a day. What madness. So much worse than tragic. What to do except dance. Dance. Only dance. She was surprisingly graceful and light on her feet, the neck and head and shoulder gestures of Bharatanatyam automatic for her, eyebrows shooting up and down, eyeballs flitting to the edges of their sockets, feet moving, a rigid smile on her face, and all this while holding the babies in her arms. Outside the hospital, as the lights faded, the lions in the cages near the Siddhist Kilo monument, anticipating the slabs of meat the keeper would fling through the bars, roared with hunger and impatience. In the foothills of Entoto, the hyenas heard and paused as they neared the edge of the city, three steps forward and one back, cowardly and opportunistic. The emperor in his palace made plans for a state visit to Bulgaria and perhaps to Jamaica, where he had followers, Rastas, who took their name from his pre-coronation name of Ras Teferi, and who thought he was God, an idea he didn't mind his own people believing, but when it came from so far away and for reasons that he didn't understand, made him wary. The last 48 hours had irrevocably altered Hema's life. She had two infants squinting up at her from time to time as if to confirm their arrival, their good fortune. Hema felt light-headed, giddy. I won the lottery without buying a ticket, she thought. These two babies plugged a hole in my heart that I didn't know I had until now. But there was danger in the analogy. She'd heard of a railway porter at Madras Central Station who'd won lakhs and lakhs of rupees, only to have his life fall apart so that he soon returned to the platform. When you win, you often lose. That's just a fact. There's no currency to straighten a warped spirit or open a closed heart, a selfish heart. She was thinking of Stone. Stone had prayed for a miracle. The silly man didn't see that these newborns were miracles. They were obstetric miracles for surviving his assault. Hamer decided to name the first twin to breathe Marion. Marion Sims, she would tell me later, was a simple practitioner in Alabama, USA, who had revolutionized women's surgery. He was considered the father of obstetrics and gynecology, the patron saint. In naming me for him, she was both honoring him and giving thanks. "And Shiva for Shiva," she said, naming the child with the circular hole in his scalp, the last to breathe, the child she had labored over, a child all but dead until she had invoked Lord Shiva's name, at which point he took his first gasp.
"Yes, Marion and Shiva."
She tacked on praise to both names after their mother. And finally, reluctantly, almost as an afterthought, but because you cannot escape your destiny, and so that he wouldn't walk away scot-free, she added our surname, the name of the man who had left the room. Stone. Part 2. When a pole goes into a hole, it creates another soul, which is either a pole or a hole. Newton's fourth law of motion, as taught by the mighty senior sirs of Madras Christian College during the initiation ragging of A. Ghosh, Junior Pisser Katan, Batch of 1938, St. Thomas Hall, D. Block, Tambaram, Madras. Chapter 11. Bedside Language and Bedroom Language. On the morning of the twins' birth, Dr. Avi Ghosh awoke in his quarters to the sound of pigeons cooing on the windowsill. The birds had figured in his waking dream in which he swung from the giant banyan tree outside his boyhood home in India. He'd been trying to peek at the wedding being conducted indoors, but even with the birds using their wings to wipe the windows, he couldn't see. Now that Ghosh was awake, only the ancient banyan tree, which had stood in the shared courtyard, still felt vivid. Its branches were supported by pillar-like aerial roots, which to a child appeared to have shot up from the ground instead of the other way around. Immovable through the Madras monsoons and through the dog days of summer, that tree had been his protector and guide. The cantonment near St. Thomas Mount, on the outskirts of Madras, teemed with railway and military brats. It suited a fatherless child, particularly one whose mother was too defeated by her husband's death to be of much use to her children. Anand Ghosh, a Bengali from Calcutta, had been posted to Madras by the Indian Railways. He met his future wife, the Anglo-Indian daughter of the Parambar station master, at a railway dance to which he had gone on a lark. Neither family approved of the marriage. They had two children, first a girl, then a boy. Little Abhi Ghosh was a month old when his father died of hepatitis. He grew into a self-sufficient, fun-loving child who met the world head-on. When he came of age, he dropped the E at the end of his name because he thought it redundant, like a skin tag. In his first year of medical school, his mother died. His sister and her husband pulled away, resentful that the cantonment house came to him. His sister made it clear that he ceased to exist for her, and in time he saw this was true. The mornings were when Ghosh felt Hema's absence from missing the most. Her bungalow, hidden by hedges, was a shout away from his, but it was locked up and silent. Whenever she went on holiday in India, his life became unbearable because he was terrified that she'd return married. At the airport, before Hema left, he'd been dying to blurt out, "Hema, let's get married." But he knew she would have thrown her head back and laughed. He loved her laughter, but not at his expense. He had swallowed his marriage proposal.
"Fool,"
she had said before boarding when he asked her yet again if she intended to see prospective bridegrooms.
"How long have you known me? Why do you keep thinking I need a groom in my life? I'll find a bride for you, I'll tell you what. You're the one who is matrimonially obsessed."
Hema saw his jealousy as a little joke. Ghosh played at wooing her, or so she believed, and she played her role by fending him off. If she only knew how tormented he was by uninvited images. Hema in bridal sari, weighed down with 10 sovereign gold necklace. Hema seated next to ugly groom, garlands piled around their necks like the yoke on water buffalo.
Go ahead, what do I care?
He said aloud, as if she were in the room.
But ask yourself, can he love you the way I love you? What's the use of education if you let your father lead you like a cow to the Brahma bull?
That led him to picture a bovine penis. He groaned. This time, when Hema's departure appeared inevitable, Ghosh did something different. He quietly mailed out applications for an internship in America. Granted, he was 32 years old, but it wasn't too late to start again. Mailing the envelope gave him a sense of controlling his destiny, more so when Cook County Hospital in Chicago cabled that they were sending a voucher for a plane ticket. When the letter and contract arrived, they didn't diminish his anxiety about Hema, but it did make him feel less helpless. From the kitchen, Ghosh heard the violent clang of Almaz extracting water from Mussolini.
For the sake of God, be gentle,
he called out, as he did most days. The stove had 3 rings, but it was the bulging oven below which resembled a certain fallen dictator's potbelly that gave it its name. Set into its side was a metal cavity so that whenever the stove was lit, water was heated. Almaz grumbled about having to split wood, then stoke the fire in Mussolini. All for what? To make 1 cup of that vile powder coffee for the geta? In the mornings, Ghosh preferred instant to the semi-solid Ethiopian brew. But it wasn't the coffee he valued as much as the hot water for his bath. He drew the blanket over his head as Almaz staggered to the bathroom, hefting the steaming cauldron.
Banya skin,
she muttered in Amharic. Amharic was all she ever spoke, though Ghosh suspected she understood more English than she let on. After emptying the cauldron into the bathtub, she finished the thought.
It must be so sickly to require washing every day. What misfortune the geta doesn't have Habesha skin. It would stay clean without the need for all this scrubbing.
No doubt Almaz had been to church this morning. When Ghosh first came to Ethiopia, as he walked down Menelik Street, a woman across the road stopped and bowed to him and he waved back. Only later did he realize that her gesture was aimed at the church across the way. Pedestrians bobbed before a church, kissing the church wall thrice and crossing themselves before going on. If they'd been chased, they might enter. Otherwise, they stayed on the other side of the street. Almaz was tall, with oak-colored skin and a shield-shaped face. Her oval eye sloped down to the bridge of her nose, giving her a sultry, inviting gaze. Her square chin contradicted that message, and this hint of androgyny brought her admiring looks. She had large but shapely hands, wide hips, and buttocks that formed a broad ledge on which Ghosh believed he could balance a cup and a saucer. She was 26 when she came to Missing with labor pains, 9 months pregnant, her cheeks flushed with pride because this baby she would carry to term, unlike all the others that had failed to take root in her womb. In the prenatal clinic visits, nursing students had twice recorded FHSH, fetal heart sounds heard, in the chart. But on the day of her putative labor, Hema heard only silence. Hema's exam revealed that the baby was a giant fibroid of the uterus and the FHSH nothing but a rattle in a probationer's brain. Almaz refused to accept the diagnosis.
Look,
she said, fishing out an engorged breast and squeezing forth a jet of milk.
Could a tit do that if there was no child to feed?
Yes, a tit could do that and more if its owner believed. It took 3 months with no true signs of labor and an X-ray that showed no baby skull, no spine, for Almaz to concede. At the surgery, which she at last agreed to, Hema had to remove both the fibroid and the uterus which it had swallowed. In the town of Sabata, they still waited for Almaz to return with the baby. But Almaz couldn't bear to go back. She stayed on and became one of the missing people. He heard Almaz return and the jangle of a cup and saucer. The scent of coffee made him peek from under his tent.
"Is there anything else?"
she asked, studying him.
"Yes, I need to tell you that I am leaving missing. Really, I am. I can't let Hema play me like a harmonium."
But he didn't say this. Instead, he shook his head. He felt Almaz understood intuitively what Hema's absence did to him.
"Jesus Christos, please forgive this sinner, but he was out drinking last night,"
she said as she stooped to pick up a beer bottle from under the bed. Alas, Almaz was in a proselytizing mood. Ghosh felt as if he were eavesdropping on her private conversation with God. What a bad idea it had been to give the Bible to anyone but priests, Ghosh thought. It made a preacher out of everybody.
"Blessed Saint Gabriel, Saint Michael, and all the other saints," she continued in Amharic,
confident he would understand,
"for I prayed for Master to be a new man, for him to one day give up his durie ways, but I was wrong, your venerable holiness."
It was the word durie that tricked Ghosh into speaking. It meant lout, lecher, reprobate. And it stung him to hear that word.
"What gives you the right to address me this way?"
he said, though he didn't really feel the anger his voice carried. He was about to add, "Are you my wife?" but choked those words off. To his perpetual shame, he and Almaz had been intimate twice over the years, both times when he was drunk. She'd lain down, lifted, and spread, grumbling even as her hips fell into rhythm with his, but no more than she grumbled about the coffee or hot water. He'd decided that grumbling with Almaz was the language of both pleasure and pain. When they were spent, she sighed, pulled her skirt down, and asked,
"Will there be anything else?"
before leaving him to his guilt. He loved her for never holding those two episodes against him, but it had given her the license to nag him, to raise her grumbling to a steady pitch. That was her prerogative, but the saints help anyone else who addressed him in that tone. She defended him, his belongings, and his reputation with her tongue and with her fists and feet if necessary. Sometimes he felt that she owned him.
"Why do you harass me like this?"
he said, the fire gone from his voice. He knew he'd never have the courage to break the news of his leaving to her.
"Who said I was talking to you?"
Almaz replied. But when she left, he saw the two aspirins in the saucer with his coffee, and his heart melted. My greatest consolation, Ghosh thought, for only the 100th time since his arrival in Ethiopia, has been the women of this land. The country had completely surprised him. Despite pictures he'd seen in National Geographic, he'd been unprepared for this mountain empire shrouded in mist. The cold, the altitude, the wild roses, the towering trees reminded him of Kunur, a hill station in India he'd visited as a boy. His Imperial Majesty, Emperor of Ethiopia, may have been exceptional in his bearing and dignity, but Ghosh discovered that His Majesty's people shared his physical features. Their sharp, sculpted noses and soulful eyes set them between Persians and Africans, with the kinky hair of the latter and the lighter skin of the former. Reserved, excessively formal, and often morose, they were quick to anger, quick to imagine insults to their pride. As for theories of conspiracy and the most terrible pessimism, surely they'd cornered the world market on those. But get past all those superficial attributes, and you found people who were supremely intelligent, loving, hospitable, and generous.
"Thank you, Almaz,"
he called out. She pretended not to hear. In the bathroom, Ghosh felt a sharp pain as he peed and was forced to cut off his stream.
"Like sliding down the edge of a razor blade, using my balls as brakes," he muttered, his eyes tearing.
What did the French call it?
Chaud pisse.
But that didn't come close to describing his symptoms. Was this mysterious irritation from lack of use? Or from a kidney stone? Or was there, as he suspected, a mild endemic inflammation along the passage that carried urine out? Penicillin did nothing for this condition, which waxed and waned. He'd devoted himself to this question of causation, spending hours at the microscope with his urine and with that of others with similar symptoms, studying it like the piss-pot prophets of old. After his first liaison in Ethiopia, and the only time he'd not used a condom, he had relied on the Allied Army field method for post-exposure prophylaxis, as it was called in the books. Wash with soap and mercuric chloride, then squeeze silver proteinate ointment into the urethra and milk it down the length of his shaft. It felt like a penance invented by the Jesuits. He believed the prophylaxis was partly behind the burning sensations that came and went and peaked on some mornings. How many other such time-honored methods out there were just as useless? To think of the millions that the armies of the world had spent on kits like this, or to think that before Pasteur's discovery of microbes, doctors fought duels over the merits of balsam of Peru versus tar oil for wound infection. Ignorance was just as dynamic as knowledge, and it grew in the same proportion. Still, each generation of physicians imagined that ignorance was the special provenance of their elders. There was nothing like a personal experience to tilt a man towards a specialty. And so, Ghosh had become the de facto syphilologist, the venereologist, the last word when it came to VD. From the palace to the embassies, every VIP with VD came to consult Ghosh. Perhaps in the county of Cook in America, they'd be interested in this experience. After he bathed and dressed, he drove the 200 yards to the outpatient building. He sought out Adam, the one-eyed compounder who, under Ghosh's tutelage, had become a natural and gifted diagnostician. But Adam wasn't around, and so he went to W.W. Gonad, a man of many titles, laboratory technician, blood bank technician, junior administrator, all of which were to be found on a name tag on his oversized white coat. His full name was Wande Wosin Gonifer, which he'd westernized to W.W. Gonad. Ghosh and Matron had been quick to point out the meaning of his new moniker, but it turned out that W.W. needed no edification.
"The English have names like Mr. Strong, Mr. Wright, Mr. Head, Mr. Carpenter, Mr. Mason, Mrs. Moneypenny, Mr. Rich. I will be Mr. W.W. Gonad."
He was one of the first Ethiopians Ghosh had come to know well. Outwardly melancholic, W.W. was nevertheless fun-loving and ambitious. Urbanization and education had introduced in W.W. a gravitas, an exaggerated courtliness, the neck and body flexed, primed for the deep bow, and conversation full of the sighs of someone whose heart had been broken. Alcohol could either exaggerate the condition or remove it entirely. Ghosh asked W.W. to give him a B12 shot. It was worth a try. Even placebos had some effect. As he readied the syringe, W.W. made clucking noises.
"You must be sure to always use prophylactics, Dr. Ghosh," he said, and immediately turned sheepish, because W.W. was hardly one to proffer such advice.
"But I do. After that first time, I've never had unrubberized intercourse. Don't you believe me? That is why I don't understand this burning some mornings. And you, sir, why don't you use a condom, W.W.?"
Gonad wore heel lifts that made him walk with an ostrich-like pelvic tilt. He teased his hair into a lofty halo that would one day be called an afro. Now he pulled himself to his full 5'1" and said haughtily,
"If I wanted to make love to a rubber glove, I would never have to leave the hospital."
If Ghosh had been aware that at this very moment Sister Mary Joseph Praise was in distress in her quarters, he'd have rushed to help. It might have saved her life. But at that point, no one knew. The probationer had yet to deliver her message, and when she did, she failed to tell anyone how sick Sister was. Ghosh made leisurely rounds with the ward nurse and the probationers. He pointed out a sulfur rash to the newest probationers, removed acidic fluid from the belly of a man with cirrhosis. The outpatient clinics then took most of the day, except for a formal lecture to the nursing students on tuberculosis. Keeping busy helped him forget about Hema, who should have been back 2 days ago. He could think of only one explanation for her delay, and it depressed him. In the late afternoon, Ghosh drove out of Missing. He missed by a few minutes the hue and cry when Thomas Stone carried Sister Mary Joseph Braes out of the nurse's hostel. He parked near the towering Lion of Judah.